on day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall. We will use the best technology, including above and below ground sensors, that's the tunnels. Remember that, above and below. Above and below ground sensors.
Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're going to love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are going to make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, a.k.a. Saki Christoulos.
So, welcome to episode 27, I think, of the Security Perimeter Podcast. I know it's been a heck of a long time since I put a new podcast up, but there's a couple of things going on. Number one, I had a trip to Canada that had to take care of some family issues that went on for about 10 days. Then there was an earthquake in Mexico, as many of you know, many of you lived. This is the big news. The big news is that then we put together a web page called the securityperimeter.com. I actually even got my own domain name, thesecurityperimeter.com, which, by the way, has every single episode that I've ever done on the Security Perimeter podcast. Plus, it also has a few other things, like, for example, fake Russian news, an entire section on fake Russian news broken down by different types of categories, like fake Russian news on U.S. politics, fake Russian news on Russian politics, fake Russian news on the U.S. Army. So, really, I encourage you. It took us a heck of a long time to do this thing. Probably took about 10 days of my life, plus 10 days, maybe more, of the life of my assistant, Facundo, to do this thing. And so please go to thesecurityperimeter.com, and you can get all the episodes, including this one. And you can also check out some other pretty neat stuff, like, some things that I've written, really down-to-earth, and what I believe to be the largest compendium of Russian fake news on the face of the planet. So today's guest is, once again, Alan Berson, former Undersecretary of State for Homeland Security, and also known as the Borders Are under the Clinton administration. And it's a talk that he gave at the university that I work at, ITAM, last week. And it's a talk on Donald Trump and the future of North America, but he ends up talking quite a bit about DACA and deportations under the Obama administration, a process that he was directly involved in. But the other thing is that, you know, Alan also tells us in this talk that he was one of the people that helped draft the DACA, the Deferred Action Program, to register some Mexican and foreign kids who weren't born in the United States but were brought over by their parents and really don't know any other country other than the United States. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they are American. And he's got some really nice ideas about the future of North America and what's going to happen with all of that stuff going on right now as they negotiate the, I think is the fourth round of the renegotiation of NAFTA. So without further ado, I'll take you straight into the podcast with Alan and his talk on Donald Trump and the future of North America. And please, patronize the securityperimeter.com, the webpage that I just told you about, which has awesome, awesome fake Russian news. Like I said before, it's probably the largest compendium of fake Russian news on the face of the planet. But I don't only pick on the Russians, I also pick on the alt-right in the United States, and there's an entire section on them as well. And, of course, the other thing about the webpage is that you can get the podcasts, like I said. So I know I'm pushing this, but let me repeat it once again. It's the website is called thesecurityperimeter.com. One word, thesecurityperimeter.com.
We are in a period of huge transition in Mexico as well as in the United States, and I submit to you all over the world, because we are in one of these periods of history where the underlying reality of work and culture and family has actually been dramatically affected by the forces of globalization, by the fact that we live in a cyber environment. Cyber is not something separate, particularly for your generation. Cyber is the world that we live in. So it's not that you have to analyze the cyber dimensions of contemporary life. Contemporary life is cyberspace. That is what we live in. And it is dramatically changing the way in which the world is organized, even more so than globalization did over the last generation, from the 1980s to now, with the beginning of the internet. So what happened in the United States, and could very well happen in Mexico in its own form, is that our politics, which is always lagging the realities, did not meet the needs of people. So that the election, which, as President Trump reminds everyone, was a complete surprise, I dare say, perhaps even to him and to his advisors, but it was a indication of a change in American politics. The division that has been happening in the United States between the so-called red states and the blue states is something that was actually happening since the time of Richard Nixon, when the Republican Party basically relocated its power base to the south of the country. When I was growing up, the south, it was segregationist, but it was democratic. From the time of Franklin Roosevelt to the time of Lyndon Johnson, the southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, were Democratic states. They were, in today's terms, blue states. Starting with the racial, results of the civil rights movement in the 60s, there was a real reaction, and the South became the basic center of the Republican Party. That has fundamentally then started this tremendous and very dangerous polarization in American politics between the red and the blue. And democratic politics requires a vibrant middle, because you have to be able to make a deal. You have to be able to put aside partisanship and do, in fact, what happened at the beginning of the Peña Nieto administration, El Pacto de México. The dramatic reforms that took place in 2012, 2013. The United States dealt with its major problems over time by having Democrats and Republicans find their way in the middle and come up with solutions, so that Social Security, that was very controversial in the Roosevelt era, was adopted by President Eisenhower, the Republican president after World War II. And this was the pattern in which we operated. There have been very few periods in our history where we are so polarized. The only one that strikes me as being comparable to today was in the 1850s, before the Civil War, in 1861. But I have great confidence that we will find a way back to dialogue, but we're not there now. So that when you have a horrible shooting, yet once again, of the kind that we saw in Las Vegas, the horror is that in the past there would have been Republican senators and Democratic senators who would have come together, as they did in the Clinton years, and ban assault weapons. But today, we don't have that middle ground. And we've seen, therefore, what happened with the Affordable Care Act in the Obama years. So where does Donald Trump come from? The fact is that he was responding to a core group of mostly white, mostly people my age, who have been completely dislocated by the forces of globalization, who have seen their families lose jobs, lose income, who were sitting at the top of their communities in the middle class, and suddenly there's no opportunities for their children. The results are that communities in the Middle West and cities that were vibrant centers of American life, St. Louis, Kansas City, Des Moines, Iowa, Omaha, Nebraska, have really been impacted dramatically by the loss of the industrial base. And the result has been hollowed out communities, people who are hopeless, whose children have been succumbing to opiates and to an opioid addiction, to the tune of 60,000 young and not so young Americans dying from addiction. So you say, in that context, you see an election in which all of the expected results don't happen. All of the polling that was done did not reflect this rising up of, in a populist way, of people who are at the end of their ropes. From my perspective, as someone who is sympathetic to that phenomenon, it strikes me that the belief that Donald Trump will be the answer, a billionaire from New York City, is somehow the answer to the cries of people, that remains to be seen, and I hope the president rises to the occasion. I've seen nothing to suggest that he will. On the other hand, that he was elected and that people were reaching out desperately, because neither the Republican Party traditionally or the Democrats, my party, had been responsive to their plight, to their needs. So that the election of Donald Trump, the fact that voters in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan actually turned and led to this extraordinary result is a wake-up call, but it's an indication that we are at a turning point in American political history. So what was the Trump campaign? And this is where, you know, the impact on Mexico was so unfortunate, because when you are a populist political leader, when you respond to people's fears, pain, and they are desperate, the two things that you usually attack in American history are immigration, even though we are a nation of immigrants, and everything that our country is basically, everything that it has achieved is due to the immigrants who have come to the country. There is also this sense that there's a populist underbelly and an ugliness, so that the most anti-immigrant people are the people who themselves have been immigrants two generations before. That's a populist phenomenon that we see, but that's what happened here. So the second thing is you blame people for the loss of your jobs. And I will argue later to you that NAFTA is the most important thing that's happened to both of our countries in either of our histories, in terms of creating an economic production platform that will determine, unless it is thrown overboard, will continue to bring prosperity to both nations. But in the context of people who think they lost their job because of the movement of factories, auto factories to Guanajuato and Puebla and Querétaro, the facts that those jobs were actually leaving in any event because of automation and because of productivity is not an argument that people want to hear. So the populism, which combines attacks on trade and attacks on immigration, who is going to be the immediate victim but but the country that is closest to us. And in fact, Canada did not escape those kinds of populist attacks. So when the election turned out the way it did, there was obviously great concern in Mexico and among those of us in the United States who understand the importance of Mexico in its own right, but also to the United States and to our future, there was concern. So you will get to know me, and as my wife says, he is often wrong, but he is never uncertain. So, but I was not wrong in saying 2 weeks after the election at a conference in Puebla, I said that I was concerned and that we would have to see what the new president and his administration would do, but that what has happened between our countries in the last generation, since President Salinas and President H.W. Bush negotiated NAFTA, TLAC, and since what has happened in those 25 years will not have created a set of facts on the ground in terms of business relationships, personal relationships, social relationships that will not be denied and cannot be ignored. And I submit to you, although we are now moving into the fourth round of the renegotiation of NAFTA, in November, the rhetoric was, we will scrap NAFTA, we will exit NAFTA and end NAFTA, and so far we're now finished with three rounds of negotiations that have been kept reasonably confidential, and we are going into the fourth. My attitude remains that the bonds that exist between our countries cannot be torn apart. It's not to say that there will not be difficulties in the road ahead, but the situation that has emerged between our countries are dramatic changes in both countries. So let's just look at the Mexican situation before we look at the U.S. situation. Mexico has become basically a middle-class country. Plenty of issues of inequality to address that your generation will have to continue the movement that's taken place, but 50% of Mexicans are middle class. Mexico has got the 12th or 13th largest economy in the world, not in the Western Hemisphere, in the world, and is predicted by the OECD to have the fourth largest economy, an economy larger than Germany, by the time you're my age and before that. One generation, Mexico will be the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world. Mexico, in one generation, has created a robust democracy. Democratic politics is not neat. It's a contact sport. But Mexico has often a more honest electoral system in terms of elections than we do in many of our states, and a robust press that increasingly, together with the Congress, has creating a democracy for the next generation, has created a democracy for the next generations of Mexican society. These are dramatic changes, and it has been done with impacts that have created millions of jobs for the United States. Let me just say parenthetically, the reason that NAFTA got off to such a bad start was that, in fact, Ross Perot was the candidate against Bill Clinton in the 1992 election, and he ran his campaign against NAFTA, saying that there would be this huge sucking sound of jobs leaving the United States and going to Mexico. But the fact of the matter is the academic studies that have been done at the University of California at San Diego and at Georgetown that I've seen are pretty persuasive that the major losses of jobs that have taken place in states like Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin, Omaha and Iowa in Nebraska and Iowa are due to automation, to the mechanization of production processes, not to the growth of the economy in Mexico. Because in fact, as any economist knows, when the pie gets bigger for everyone, it grows and it overcomes the issues about marginal losses. Now, that is not to say that there were not specific situations where people lost their job because of a relocation of a factory. But I would say that that was then the failure of having social policy that would use the community colleges in our country to retrain people, to provide support for people as there was a transition in their lives. But the notion, I think, that the growth of Mexico was at the expense of the United States is simply inconsistent with the facts that the pie got much bigger as Mexico became the 12th largest economy in the world. So let's see what happens in the NAFTA negotiation. Frankly, when the negotiation started, I thought that it was long overdue, because in fact, there were many things that, that a 24-year-old treaty needed to be updated on. Digital life did not exist in 1994 in ways that need to be taken up in the treaty. Intellectual property is a wholly different discipline that needs to be taken up by the discussions. We need to have a new system that addresses labor issues, both in Mexico and in the United States. We need to address environmental issues much more effectively. All of that could be a big plus that could come out of this negotiation. And I believe, actually, that the creation of e-commerce, the building of e-commerce online between our countries, so that people who prepare a good artisan beer in Brooklyn can sell it to the students of ITAM in Mexico City, and that people who produce excellent crafts in Chihuahua can actually sell online anywhere in the United States or in Europe. E-commerce is something that needs to be done, and I believe might come out of the negotiations. It's been resisted because of the so-called de minimis here in Mexico, that is a $50 de minimis, which means that anything that is valued at more than $50 has to go through cumbersome customs processes. The U.S., during the time that I was the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, with the support of the Obama administration, raised the de minimis to $800. There's also an issue of VAT. Some of my Mexican friends in the government say we can't have e-commerce because the value-added tax needs to be collected. Well, I would, as I point out to them, the Europeans solved that problem a long time ago in terms of the Schengen system, and I think could overcome that. But whether it's taken up or not, this treaty negotiation is actually an opportunity. It's a danger, but as the Chinese character for danger for crisis indicates, it's a combination of two characters, one for crisis, for danger, and one for opportunity. So too, this negotiation is a potential crisis, but it's with its danger, but it's also a potential opportunity. But the facts on the ground, the trade that exists is in fact the concepts, and I challenge some of those of you who will go on to be the economists of the next generation. We talk about the trade having grown in the last 25 years between Mexico and the United States as having gone from 80 billion to just under 700 billion, a factor of 10 nearly. But we look at that in terms of international trade. But the fact is that the United States and Mexico are not trading internationally. We're part of the same production platform. We have shared production platforms. So every time a car rolls off an assembly line in Guanajuato and is shipped to the United States or out of Mexico, 40% of that value has been generated in the United States. And in fact, the parts are moving back and forth across the border 6 or 7 times, so that when you have this cross-border trade, it's not international trade in the classical sense. It's It's actually parts of an internal production process between Mexican and U.S. Companies that are part of the same supply chain, part of the same productive mechanism. So we need to talk about it differently than international trade, but we don't have the language for that. In the same way that we don't have the right language to talk about the relationship between our two countries, that I pointed out to the group last night, that, you know, we're not international. We're not foreign. But we're not domestic either, because we have separate sovereignties that we actually respect. So there's a term that was coined in the 1970s by a law professor named Bayless Manning that to me expresses very well what we are, Mexico and the United States, and Canada and the United States, and Mexico and Canada in the next generation, which is we are not international and we're not domestic, but we're intermestic. Our relationship is intermestic, that what happens in one country affects the domestic affairs of the other country. You know, it was Ronald Reagan, of all people, who said, we should stop referring to Mexico and Canada as foreigners, Mexicans and Canadians as foreigners, because they're actually our neighbors. So I take it one step further, because neighbors can move away from one another. We're beyond neighbors. We're now in a relationship that is extraordinary, and the potential is extraordinary. And let me spend, before I open it up to questions, let me just talk about you're all 18 to 22 years old. So in 2050, you'll be in middle age. You'll have children, professions, and some of you will have children in college. El futuro ya no es lo que era antes. The future is actually, and this is why it's so ironic that we're arguing over NAFTA, because NAFTA was just an agreement to remove investment and trade controls. The fact is that the three countries, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, are the core of potentially the most important bloc in the next 50 years in world history and geopolitics. There are those who say that the rise of China and the setting of the sun on the United States dominance since World War II is a fact that is accomplished. The rise and the transformation of China, which I have tried to follow carefully, is one of the really dramatic transformations in human history, and in fact is an extraordinary transformation. I often point out that it's so extraordinary that people have missed the transformation that's taken place in Mexico during the same period of time, because China was a country 10 times the size of Mexico, and it was coming from it's had a history that is 10 times as long as North American history. But the fact is that China has deep, deep issues that it has to deal with, what the Marxists used to call inherent contradictions between a tremendously, relatively open economic system, state control to be sure, but a very, very tight political system. And that is a contradiction, and knowing the 400 million Chinese middle class young people that now exist, it is going to be very difficult to keep them within a totalitarian regime over the next generation. But even put aside this is not to criticize China, it's to say the potential for North America, for your generation, generations of Americans and Canadians, want you to listen carefully to these competitive advantages that we have here in North America. A half a billion people, more than 560 million people. Right now, we have a joint gross domestic product of the three countries of $23.2 trillion. That's 30% of the global, the gross global product, the production product, 30% North America. We have energy independence among the three countries on the horizon, self-sufficiency, no regard for having to be involved in the geopolitics of the Middle East, which has been the story of American foreign policy to a large degree in the last 20 years, 25 years, some would argue 50 years. We have borders that are trade friendly and not closed or militarized. Think about the situation of a country like Turkey with eight neighbors, or a country like Iraq, or a country like Iran, or a country like Russia. And the nature of the border, and think about the competitive advantage of having borders like ours that are not open, but that are permeable, and in which millions of people cross them, both for tourist and business and immigration, migration purposes. Think about the enormous natural resources that we have independent of hydrocarbons, the flowing rivers of southern Mexico, or of Quebec, or the Mississippi, or the Missouri. And there are those who argue that water will be the key natural resource of the next 100 years. Think about the advantages we have with the great agricultural areas that exist in the plains of Canada, the United States, and the fertility of Mexico and the productivity of Mexican agriculture. Think about the advantages of three nations that are dedicated to democracy and a democratic rule of law. All three imperfect and still moving toward that ideal. But these are enormous, enormous competitive advantages. And if we take advantage of them over the next generation, North America will be the leading, most competitive continental bloc in the world. And this is just not the three countries. For me, North America is from Colombia to the Arctic, and from Bermuda in the Atlantic Ocean to Hawaii in the Pacific. All three of our nations, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, are Pacific powers. And while President Trump has disbanded participation by the U.S. in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I don't think the last chapter has been written on that story either. And Mexico and Canada will continue to keep open that door. Mexico and Colombia are the gateway to the Pacific Alliance of Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile, with an eye to linking North America to the Far East and to help negotiate our relationships with East Asia. Mexico, the United States, and Canada are Atlantic powers and have a relationship and will continue to do so with the European powers of the common, of the Eurozone and the common market. What we need to do is start to understand that North America and the economic powerhouse of Mexico, the United States, and Canada is actually the answer to the problems in the Northern Triangle of El Salvador, Honduras, and Salvador, and that Mexico will play a leading role as industry here goes up and becomes more technologically proficient, the lower manufacturing will and should, as it moved from the United States to Mexico, move to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. The Caribbean needs to be incorporated. Not many people, but a strategic part of the perimeter security that actually will surround North America. And I predict that before you do have your children go to college, there will be North American aduaneros, of Mexican descent who were actually clearing people into North America in Paris. And let me end then and open it up to questions by saying, todos somos norteamericanos. No longer is it acceptable for the term norteamericano to refer only to estadounidenses. Todos somos norteamericanos. It is really the key to a future that is extraordinarily open. So that when people say in my country that America is in decline and we make, and the idea is to make America great again, the answer is that America had the United States had a terrific run after World War II. And frankly, for all the mistakes my country's made, after World War II, 3% of the world was middle class, and today more than 40% of the world with a much larger population is middle class. So the United States actually, for the first imperial power in history that actually recognized that its idealism, that when the pie gets bigger, everyone needs to share in it. And I would, for that reason, I say the period of the American century had many good benefits for all of the difficulties that were created. But the American century is definitely setting. There's no question about that in my mind. But it may be setting in the context of a North American century that's actually just beginning. And the North American idea is something that I hope all of you will take the time to think about and build it into your DNA, because it has a lot to do with the future for your children and grandchildren that is, as Ronald Reagan used to say, a city on the hill. My father, may he rest in peace, and he was a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. He'd say, you've now quoted Ronald Reagan twice. But I think Ronald Reagan actually will turn out to be viewed as, I believe, your current president in much better... He will look much better in history than he was viewed at the time. But that's a secondary point. The main point is that todos somos norteamericanos, and the North American century is just beginning, and I hope all of you become vibrant parts of that world professionally and personally. And with that, I'd be delighted to answer your questions, and to do so very straightforwardly.
Can we have a round of applause? I don't see an assistant, my assistant here. Eddie? No? Come down and help us with the microphone, Eddie. If you could say your name, so Alan... Not because the CIA is going to...
Hi, my name is Sophia, and well, first of all, thank you a lot for coming. Well, I would like to ask you if you could tell us a little bit more about your job during the Obama administration, and well, being this one, the one with the greatest deportation like ever, and if you believe that this has had an economic impact in the United States.
Yes. So the question asks, I was involved, and I was part of the team that under President Obama did more deportations than had ever been done before. And I'll be very straightforward. These were not deportations of people being rounded up so much in their homes, because the priorities of Janet Napolitano and Jay Johnson, President Obama, would not to go and do sweeps on the street or sweeps in houses. The people who were not who were deported were people who were actually apprehended close to the border and returned in ways that were in coordination with the NAME Mexican authorities, in ways that are were humane and safe. So that, yes, there were deportations, but these were people who were captured or restrained at or near the border. And the reason for that And the reason the Obama administration felt that that was important was that border security and the rule of law is important. You cannot have open borders. And I think Mexico, I say this respectfully and with great admiration, Mexico is now seeing the same situation on its southern border with Guatemala. And you simply can't have a border that's open and have hundreds of thousands of people coming through your country, exploited by smugglers, by coyotes, abused by traffickers. So you need to have the rule of law, and you need to have safe repatriation and fair treatment. But the political reason for the deportations was that that was the predicate for what was intended to be a massive immigration reform, the so-called comprehensive immigration reform that would have permitted the 11 million people who are in the shadows, 8 million of whom are Mexican migrants, to actually regularize their status and do what would be required so that they would become documented in the United States. That kind of comprehensive immigration reform has been called for by leaders in both political parties and has not occurred, to the great consternation of many of us, because of the polarization that's taken place and the populism that dominated the 2016 election. There was a bill that was introduced by the so-called Gang of Eight, a bipartisan group of senators in 2012, 2013, that actually passed the United States Senate. And it was a very, very effective comprehensive immigration reform bill that was then rejected by the House of Representatives, the lower house of the Congress. That is regrettable. And my concern would be that comprehensive immigration reform is one of those major legislative endeavors that only comes around once in a generation. And because of the polarization in American politics, we have not been able to do it. But to answer your question directly, yes, people who tried to cross illegally into the United States during the Obama administration ran into a much more effective border security. They were apprehended in much larger numbers and they were returned to Mexico. But we did this not without consultation with Mexican authorities. And I like to say that as the borders are, I saw it in the 90s and I saw it in 2015 as the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs. And we've reached a point where the majority of migrants to the United States actually are not from Mexico, but are from Central America, that the numbers of people who are being apprehended in at the border, in the southwest border, are the lowest that they've been in 30 years, which is again why it's so ironic that the president has been so preoccupied with a wall that will never be built. But this was part of the populist politics. But yes, the rule of law requires that that you enter the borders of another nation according to the laws of that nation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next. Why don't we take that young gentleman five steps up to the left, my left.
Well, my name is Ariel. Thank you very much for the presentation. I have two really simple questions. First of all, does the actual instability of the social classes in the United States affects more than it benefits the relation between both countries? And also, does the next year's Mexican election will, in either case that AMLO wins or he loses, how do you think it will affect the relationship between both countries?
Yeah. I don't know if you got the first one.
Yeah. So, yeah, the first one was the instability in U.S. politics and the changes that are taking place in the society, a plus or a negative for our relationship. It has its difficulties. If you go back to the 2008 election, do you know who sounded the two biggest critics of NAFTA? Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Both of them in the campaign vowed to do what President Trump is now doing. Their rhetoric was almost without the, you know, the rapists and the thugs and the what that part of the rhetoric. But the attack on NAFTA was basically the same coming from the Democrats that was coming from candidate Trump. The policies of the Obama administration led to the greatest strengthening of U.S.-Mexico relations in the history of our two countries. So watch what people do rather than be focused only on what they say. And yes, there are social changes going on in both countries that will affect, that will be able to be exploited by politics and politicians in both countries. But the facts on the ground that I alluded to, I think, are stronger. As an outsider, and I watched the 2008 and 18 election in Mexico with great interest. I would not presume to comment except to say that this is a time of great change, and we will see whether or not the populism that dominated the U.S. election and the Brexit election, but did not dominate the French election or the German election, what the Mexican people will choose. That is the extraordinary dimension of democracy. And regardless of the outcome of the election, vote.
What there was, huh? Sarah.
Okay, so my name is Sarah. I wanted to go back to two main points that you mentioned before. Not main, but you mentioned that the NAFTA renegotiations are an opportunity to talk about environmental issues, and that now is an opportunity for that Canada, Mexico, and the United States to become a strong bloc and to work together, taking into account their natural resources. However, our natural resources are being affected by climate change, even today. And in the near future, that's going to get worse. And with climate change deniers being so popular in the United States right now, and President Trump being one of those main deniers, how are, in your political and educational experience, how can we change this to start acting now on those topics?
A little bit like what they used to say of Louis XIV. He's forgotten nothing and he's learned nothing. One can hardly have lived through the biblical events of the last 120 days. Two earthquakes in Mexico, the flooding of the city of Houston, the overwhelming of the Caribbean and Florida by Hurricane Maria, without thinking that maybe something is up. The rhetoric that denies climate change and refuses to confront what former Vice President Al Gore calls an inconvenient truth is a short-term phenomenon. Whether it lasts 4 years or 8 years or 12 years, the people that are rebuilding Houston and that are rebuilding La Condesa will leave no doubt with your generation that, in fact, this is something that will need to be confronted in a systematic way. The climate change the Kyoto Treaty, the Treaty of Paris that President Trump repudiated, actually is a something that is, again, the damage right now is more rhetorical than anything else because of the way in which those treaties and accords are structured. The events on the ground, the facts on the ground, will certainly change that political reality. There is inevitably a lag time between the facts and the translation of those facts into political change. Climate change, I think, will be one of those. One hopes, though, that we accelerate our responses, because, in fact, the events of the last 4 or 6 months have persuaded me that the dangers are actually mounting. And when you see the melting of the Arctic, which is a major focus for North Americans, one needs to be concerned about the impact on the environment, the oceans, and the coastal littoral areas in both of our countries and across the world. So, yes, there are deniers, but ultimately they will die out.
My name is Olina, and I would like to ask you, what do you think about DACA, the Deferred Action for Deportation? Like, what will happen now that Trump has decided to cancel it?
So, I was part of the group that engaged in the repatriations and the deportations that were talked about earlier. I'm also proud to say that I was part of the group that actually created DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. And at the time that was determined by Secretary Janet Napolitano, who is now the president of the University of California, there was no court challenge to DACA, and it enrolled 800,000 young people, mostly of Mexican descent, not entirely, but mostly of Mexican descent, who are the flower of a generation, and like yourselves, and part of the American story of having been built by immigrants. These are extraordinary young people. The president, who, give him his due, was ambivalent about DACA. Even President Trump thinks these are great kids, all of them. What was driving the Republican right was actually the contention by Attorney General Sessions that the way in which DACA was promulgated through executive action, through memoranda by Secretary Napolitano with the president's approval, is illegal. And the reason that President Trump ended the program but gave a six-month tail to it was that a group of attorneys general in the states from some red states had threatened to file suit to challenge the legality of DACA as the follow-on Obama administration, DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Early Arrivals, had been defeated in the courts. The courts found that that was not a constitutional exercise by the president. So now we have a situation in which Congress is expected to implement a DACA program. The president has been very clear that he wants Congress to do that. He's even talked to the Democrats about doing it. But the question in the minds of many people is whether or not Congress, given its polarization, is capable of doing anything. If you had indicated that the Republicans, who now control every branch of the American government, the Senate, the House, the presidency, and the Supreme Court, if you had predicted that they could not pass anything, you would have been in a minority. So there are real questions about whether Congress can actually get its act together, so to speak, to implement what the president has indicated he wants, in which case DACA would end at the end of the 6 months. I am proud to be one of the lawyers on a lawsuit filed in the Northern District of California by the law firm with which I'm affiliated, Covington & Burling, that is representing the University of California and Janet Napolitano, challenging the rescission of the DACA program by the Trump administration on a variety of legal grounds. The judge who has the case has indicated that he will rule on it before the end of the year, so that it will be in the appellate courts by the time the six-month period ends, and that is likely, or not guaranteed, that is likely to mean that the DACA participants will not be deported until the courts have determined, the appellate courts, perhaps even the Supreme Court, has decided on whether or not the DACA program will survive. So the one, there are two opportunities. Congress could actually change the situation, or the courts could reverse, as the courts have led to changes in the travel ban that was originally promulgated by President Trump at the outset of his administration. And we will see whether or not there is a judicial or a legislative solution, or either. But it would be a genuine tragedy, one that President Trump would agree would be a tragedy, were 800,000 extraordinarily productive members of American society who know no other country suddenly ejected from the United States on the grounds that they were not born in the United States and therefore are not citizens of the United States.
Hello, my name is Anza, and I would like to ask you, how do you think that the presidency of Donald Trump so far foreshadows the political future for the United States? Like, speaking in regards to the bipartisan system within the country, and also how do you think that it will affect with its international relations, for example, in Mexico? How do you think the political future of the United States will be after Trump?
Santiago, bearing in mind your time as the Californian Education Secretary, what would you say was like the factor of education's role in the appointment of Trump as president? Because one prevailing rhetoric here in Mexico seems to be like that people without that much education got a president without that much education. Like, they go hand in hand. So, taking into account your experience again, would you think that that was actually a factor to influence on the decision of him becoming president?
So let me take the second question first, and then I'll come back. You know, in a democracy, people get the president they deserve, for good and for bad. So that there are many, many issues in the United States on public education, which account for much of what I have in life is due to public education. But the achievement gap between children of color, who are now a majority, and Caucasian students, as a matter of class, much more than race, is a big issue. But the people who voted for Mr. Trump, for the most part, are college educated. And what? So I don't know that it's a. I think it was a reflection more of the dislocation than it was of blaming education, although, you know, one should never assume that being educated leads you to one political persuasion or the other. The purpose of an education is to give you a way to think about the world and then to form judgments based on your perceptions that are guided by the educational experiences, you have to be sure. But I wouldn't attribute this to problems in the educational system so much as to the conditions on the ground in many communities that have seen a weakening over the last generation. With regard to the follow-on to American politics, we are clearly at a point where the two parties are not working in a way that benefits the system or, in my view, the people. And the reason in a large continental-sized country with now 330 million people, the two-party system has a very firm place in American history. We've had third parties, but they typically, with one or two exceptions, have never survived, but they do affect the major parties. So that there could very well be the development of a purple party that tries to restore the middle of American politics so that people from the left of center and the Democratic Party who disagree with Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren find more in common with people to the right of center who have used to dominate the Republican Party but no longer do. So that there is a huge center in the American political world that has been lost and is now the two parties seem to be dominated by the more extreme elements to the left and to the right. So there could be the development of a third party, but it would be aimed at changing one of the other parties, unless we are in fact at this kind of a change in the world, a transition in the world that, like the 1850s, before the American Civil War, the Republican Party arose and elected Abraham Lincoln after 6 years of existence. I don't know that we're there, but I do smell in the air a big transition, and I'm just I'm celebrating. I've been reflecting in this way because I'm celebrating my 50th anniversary from Harvard in May, and so I've become reflective on lots of things. But it smells to me like there's change in the air, that there is. There is something that is akin to when Yeats wrote this poem, and he wrote it in the aftermath of World War I, 1919, which was a major, major change, certainly for Europe, but arguably for the rest of the world as well. So, the answer, what is slouching toward Bethlehem, is made in North America.
Why don't we take those two over there?
Okay, so my question is, wouldn't it be necessary for the northern part of America to become a powerhouse for economics in the world? Would it be necessary for the United States to stop trying to be this leader among America and just like Canada and Mexico to stop looking up to the United States so the three of them can rise together?
So the absolutely right. But when I say the American century is setting, it means that the leadership that America has given in the last 70 years, actually building a regional basis for that leadership and building the relationship with Mexico and the United States so that the NAL summit, the North American Leaders Summit, becomes a real summit in which there is real discussion of the issues that are attendant to North America, that is part of the vision. Which is that, yes, this is a North American, but unlike the European Union, we don't sacrifice our sovereignty, we don't sacrifice our culture, we don't sacrifice our identity, but we do build a political condominium, so to speak, that is reflective of the all half a billion people.